Okay, thank you. As Neil said, I'm going to try to talk to you about three experiments today, all of them testing fundamental physics. And so I better just get started if I'm going to talk about three things. We're very happy to get funding from the Canadian government, but also, especially recently, we've been getting a lot of money from foundations in the United States. And in case I don't have time to say so later, we're looking for graduate students and postdocs, experimental. maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but maybe you know friends who really want to work on a new and exciting project. So let me first talk about the proton size. I'm sure that most of you have heard about the proton puzzle. And so in the past year, we completed and published a measurement of the proton size, which we got by measuring the n equal to lambda shift in atomic hydrogen. And so that was published, I guess, in September last year. And I should point out my co-authors. I'm not talking too much about my co-authors here. So let's just look at what the n equal two energy levels of hydrogen look like. This is something that you've done in your quantum mechanics courses at some point. This is the lambda shift. These would be degenerate, of course, under Dirac theory. They're shifted in, if you want to do it in EV, by 4 micro EV. And most of that is just QED corrections, but a small fraction of it, about a half a nano EV, is due to the fact that the proton has a finite size. And so what we're trying to do is measure this very accurately so we can measure this contribution accurately, which is only a small contribution to the whole lambda shift. Well, that was only part of the QED corrections. Here's the rest of it. This is actually the correct formula for the 2s for this interval here. In all its glory. Nobody has ever doubted any of this. This is stuff that people have calculated over the last decades. And over the last two decades, nobody has found any significant correction to this. And so all of this is completely solid, and we believe that it's completely correct. The uncertainty is less than a part per million of the interval. So we're not limited by theory on this determination of the proton size. We're entirely limited by how well experimentally this is known to determine it. And as I say, more than 20 years of stability on that. So people have, it's not that people haven't been working on it. They have been continuing to work on it, but all the corrections they found have been very small. Okay, well, this is what the situation looked like 10 years ago. There are a bunch of different ways to determine the proton size, most of them coming from hydrogen spectroscopy, similar to the lambda shift that I talked about in the previous slide. Some data from electron scattering. All of the data was self-consistent, and if you averaged it, you got this interval here, and we knew how big the proton was. And then in 2010, someone did an experiment with muonic hydrogen at PSI in Switzerland. And in fact, they had a hard time finding the transition. They were tuning their lasers, trying to find a transition from the 2s to the 2p state. And of course, they were assuming that the proton was this size. And for a long time, for years, they'd never tuned their lasers far enough off to find the laser transition. They assumed they just weren't making enough muonic hydrogen to have a signal. Then finally, they decided to tune their lasers way off from where they expected it, and they found the transition. So at that point, there was a 7 standard deviation discrepancy between the average of all measurements here. This is an average of about 12 different measurements that contribute in a significant way, and this new measurement. And that became known as the proton size puzzle. And the question is, do muons and electrons lead to a different radius? Some people still believe so. I was at FSU, and someone very strongly said that I hadn't proven anything yet. So, but most people believe now that this has been resolved. I shouldn't be giving the answer to my talk right at the beginning, and likely they don't interact differently, and likely there is no new physics to be had. In fact, in the last few years, there were two measurements were done. Unfortunately, one of those measurements, one done in Paris, agreed with the old value of the proton radius, and one of them done in Germany agrees with the new value of the radius. These are two hydrogen spectroscopy measurements, and that set us up to be the people who would break the tie and decide what the radius really was. So what are we doing? We're looking at the difference between the 2s 1/2 and 2p 1/2 states. That's the 2s to 2p is exactly what they were looking at in muonic hydrogen, so we wanted to do as similar of a measurement as we could. And we used a new method. It's a variation of the Ramsey separated oscillatory fields technique, but I think it's a better one, and I think that future measurements should probably use this method. And in particularly, we measured this hyperfine interval. So the hyperfine structure complicates things a little bit, and we just are trying to measure that interval specifically. If you want to know my history of the Lamb shift, I started on the Lamb shift in 1983 when I was an undergraduate. I decided for my undergraduate project I was going to measure the Lamb shift in hydrogen. I wasn't successful. I remember going into my professor's office and saying, I don't think I'm going to finish the measurement. And he said, of course you're not. He was happy that I tried something difficult. But that led me to work for Steve Lundeen, who currently had the most precise measurement of the Lamb shift at Notre Dame for my graduate work. We thought we might measure the Lamb shift again there, but we went on to other things. But then in 2010, when this radius puzzle came up, I decided that I should get back to my roots and measure the Lamb shift. And I should note that it was 36 years between when Lamb first saw the Lamb shift and my first crack at it in 1983, and it's taken me 36 years to complete my undergraduate project. So my history of the Lamb shift is half of the history of the Lamb shift. How do we measure the Lamb shift? We start with protons, 50 keV protons. We pass it through a gas. About 50% of it neutralizes in the gas. About 4% of that is in the 2s state. Just looking at cross sections, we deflect the protons out and let the neutrals just go through our apparatus. We have them pass through some microwave fields. First, we apply a couple of fields that empty out this F equal 1 state. Remember, we're trying to measure this transition, so we're emptying out this one because they're just in the way. And then we actually drive the transition that we would like to drive. As I said, we use separated oscillatory fields, so we have two cavities here that are driving that transition. And the two cavities, so they're separated from each other, and we're using this new technique to do that, which I'll explain to you in a while. That's why this says FOSOF here. And then we have two regions that again empty out the F equal 1 state just in case some population ended up there. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out how many 2s atoms make it through this entire maze, which means they didn't. Well, the F equal 1s got removed here and here, but the F equals zeros, if they make it through here, they didn't get removed, and therefore we didn't drive the transition here, or we drove it down and then back up. Okay, so and how do we do that? We just mix the 2s and 2p state with an electric field here. When you mix them, the 2p state has a very short lifetime, 1.6 nanoseconds. It decays down, gives off a Lyman alpha photon. That Lyman alpha photon we pass through a window, a magnesium fluoride window, the only thing that will pass wavelengths, Lyman alpha wavelengths through it, and then it goes into a gas, it ionizes a gas, and produces some electrons, which we collect on an anode. So this is just sort of a high energy proportional detector once it gets into here. But just except it started with a single ionization from a UV photon instead. Okay, and so we are using this new technique. The new technique, ordinarily when you're doing separated oscillatory fields, you're looking at the difference between what happens when the two are in phase and the two are out of phase with each other. What we're doing here instead is we're driving these two at slightly different frequencies, which means that the one is getting ahead of the other in phase. So you're continuously going from in phase to out of phase back to in phase. And if you just beat these two RFs microwaves against each other, you get a beat signal. And there's the beat signal, this purple line. That's experimental data of something that's those two beating up against each other. But if you look at the signal in our detector here, the survivability of the two S atoms, they also are varying sinusoidally in time. And they're doing that because quantum mechanically, the process that happens in the first region and the second region are working constructively or destructively with each other, and depending on what the relative phase of the RF in these two regions is. So basically, at some points in time, these are in phase with each other and they're working constructively. At other times, they're out of phase and working destructively. So there's our Lyman alpha signal. And the key here is that these two signals would be exactly in phase with each other if we were driving these cavities with an RF frequency that was equal to the frequency difference, the atomic frequency difference that we had here. And why is that? That's because as the atoms go from here to here, they're gaining phase at F0, the atomic frequency, but the cavity phases are happening at the frequency of the microwave. So the propagation in phases would be matched. These things would be in phase with each other. So we have to be very careful about relative phases. It's a huge experimental detail that we have to worry about. To cancel any mistakes we make in relative phases, it's hard to know what the relative phase of the microwaves in these two regions is. We just take these two regions and we turn them around. We have the atoms see this light green region before the dark green region. And we do that by taking the entire microwave system, the microwave generator, amplifiers, and everything else. We put it inside of a box. We have a big 19-inch feed through, goes into these guys, and we turn the entire thing around. So we don't disturb the microwave system at all while we're turning it. And so here we are turning around our system. This is with the covers off everywhere, so you can see the turning happening. Usually we can't see it. And what happens is that any phase problem that we had that was causing, well, the phase difference that we see between the beat frequency and the Lyman alpha frequency, it reverses when we go the other way. And what that means is if we had a phase difference that we didn't understand, that phase difference would cancel when we take the average phase difference. So we can see it by looking at the actual data. This is as we are tuning the frequency of these separated oscillatory field regions, FOSOF regions for frequency offset separated oscillatory fields. So this is the frequency we're putting into these two regions, almost the same frequency. They're only a matter of number of hertz apart from each other, and these are in megahertz. So I can just give the average of the two frequencies here. You can see that there's a phase difference. This is the phase difference between the beat frequency and the Lyman alpha signal. And this is the phase difference that we get when we reverse the order of these two. And basically, when these two cross, that gives us the atomic frequency. We can look at that another way by taking the average of minus one and positive the other. We get these green points, which are our data. We fit the data. It looks like we fit it to a straight line. We actually fit it to a simulated line shape that took us about a year of CPU time to simulate. And it's completely consistent with a line. So you might wonder why we did that, but you know, SharkNet is free. No, it's not. It's not because of that. I'll get to why we had to do that. And we found some other ways, which I won't talk too much about, to make sure that we weren't making phase mistakes. I mean, that's a very technical thing, but very important for this measurement. So again, here, all we have to do is we have to see where this intercept zero, and that gives us our atomic frequency. So it fits well to a straight line. So even though all the modeling is there, it fits perfectly well to a straight line. These are the residuals from the straight line fit. And after 90 minutes of data collection, we were able to get a statistical uncertainty of 2 kilohertz. We were aiming to measure this to 3 kilohertz accuracy. You might think we'd been very pleased after 90 minutes because we're already at 2 kilohertz, yet we spent 8 years doing this measurement, changing every parameter we could think of in the lab to make sure that we really had a good measurement. The natural width of this transition is 100 megahertz, and we're trying to measure it to 3 kilohertz. So we're trying to split it to a part in 30,000. At that level, it isn't just a matter of getting the statistical answer, it's also being sure that you really have the right answer. So in the end, after taking lots of data to make sure that everything was all right, we took 116 sets of data like this. Most of them took many days instead of 90 minutes because they had worse signal to noise. We took different beam speeds. We took different separations between the separated oscillatory field regions. Every centimeter further we separated them, we were losing because of lifetime of the 2p state. We lost a factor of e, so we moved them another 3 centimeters or 4 centimeters further, losing 3 or 4 factors of e. We could make up for that by just taking data for much longer than 90 minutes. We used different RF fields, and we got down to a statistical uncertainty of 0.5 kilohertz, but we were still limited by systematics to get a 3 kilohertz. Uncertainty. So systematics, our biggest systematic was just time dilation, but we had lots of ways we could determine the speed of our beam. They all agreed at the 1% level, so it turns out that was no problem at all to calculate that. Just to be sure, we took some data at very different beam speeds, and we got the same answer for our final. This is the correction we had to apply, but when we apply that correction, we get the same answer. The second largest shift was this AC Stark shift. That's why we had to do all of this, these big simulations of the line shape, because the AC Stark shift, an AC Stark shift is just like a DC Stark shift. It moves the levels around, but since we're using separated oscillatory fields, the fields aren't always on. They're going from on to off, back to on. So you can't just apply a calculated shift. You have to actually do a dynamic calculation of an atom passing through these fields to see what the net shift is. And that's what these simulations were about. We could do that at different field strengths and so on. Our modeled shifts were anywhere from between 5 and 155 kilohertz, depending on which parameters, especially which RF electric field, but also which separation we used. And the consistency of the data after we applied these corrections shows us directly that we understand these shifts to 5% accuracy. And that's plenty because some of them only have a 5 kilohertz correction. We're trying to get to 3 kilohertz. So if you understand these things at 5% accuracy, it's great. Okay, so big shifts, but not terribly important. DC Stark shifts, we were worried that we might be charging surfaces, but we could show that we weren't because we made things much worse. We turned off our deflector plates, so the protons just sprayed through our entire apparatus. We got rid of all our collimation, so we really were spraying all things all around, and it didn't cause any shifts. So we don't believe that there could have been any shifts when we were doing things 100 times better. We were quite concerned that other states, hydrogen atom states, might affect things. When you do a charge exchange, it's not selective. You're not just creating the 2s state, you also create the 4S and the 6S and the 10S and the 22S, all the states of hydrogen. And some of those are relatively long-lived, and they might make it through the whole apparatus. They're not resonant with the same frequencies as the n equal 2 state, but since we're measuring to a part in 30,000 of the resonance line width, it's still possible that they would cause an effect on our line shape. And we did some simulations with higher states in, and we found that indeed it was quite possible for that to happen. So we did a lot of tests. We turned off our deflector plates. The deflector plates we simulated showed that it killed most of our n equal 3, 4, and 5 states. And so when we turn them off, we're increasing the population of those. Most importantly, though, we got rid of the one state that we do care about, this f equals 0, 2s state. We killed 90% of those. And we did it selectively with RF fields so that we weren't killing any other states. We weren't killing n equal 22 states or anything else. And so if we kill 90% of these, it should enhance by a factor of 10 the effect of other states. And we saw no shifts. And then we saw no shifts as we changed a lot of parameters that should have changed the relative populations of these states as well. Really, the one that made this experiment take 8 years was really believing that we understood our phases well enough. And in the end, we decided that the only way to make sure that we understood our phases was to stick probes directly into the two cavities and see what the phase was, relative phase was of the two cavities. We couldn't do that and have atoms go through at the same time. And so after we finished our atomic experiment, we just repeated the entire experiment with probes in instead to show that the phase we thought we had was consistent with the phase that we did have. In the end, here are our results. Different colors are different RF electric field strengths. And different shapes are different separations between the regions. We have different beam speeds, but everything's consistent. I should mention that we did this whole thing blind. So there was a blind offset that we added to our numbers before they went to our RF generator. We never knew that blind offset. It wasn't possible for us to read that blind offset. So for 8 years, we did a measurement using a new technique, having no idea whether we were even within 20 standard deviations of the previous results. And so you can imagine the day that we unblinded this was a bit of a tense day for us. And but because of the consistency of all the tests we did, the reason we blinded it was to just make sure that the fear of God was in us, that we would do every test we could possibly do so that we would believe that things would be okay when we unblinded. So we got consistent results for different parameter sets. Even if you average stuff at different parameters, it's good. In the end, rather than taking a straight weighted average of all our data, we took a straight average of the different separations. We found that all of our simulated systematics were most sensitive to the separation between the two separated regions, and so we just took a straight average of those. In the end, we got a 3.2 kilohertz uncertainty. Of that, the breakdown was 1.4 kilohertz from statistics, 2.3 from AC shifts, 1.0 from time dilation, and 1.5 from phase uncertainties, and there's the big answer. Here is where we found the proton size to be derived from our measurement. And I would argue that at this point, the proton size puzzle is basically resolved. Why do I say that? Well, we have two measurements, each with about as much weight as the original whole set of measurements combined. And we have this really, really nice measurement that is far more accurate than any other measurement, and which doesn't have, you know, 100 systematic effects that they have to worry about. This one is really only splitting a line to a part in 30, and it has no systematic. It has no systematic corrections at all in it. Muonic hydrogen is very good for not having systematic corrections because the energy levels are so far apart from each other. So basically, I would say that you'd have to have overwhelming evidence that it's over here compared to over here. And I would say that by now, it should be more or less decided. Since then, there's also been one more measurement from electron scattering, which comes out there. And although I didn't put it on the graph because people haven't yet published them, there are three more measurements that have been done, all in one lab in Garching, but three different intervals, which all agree with the small radius. So
electron scattering, what are they?
What's this one?
No, what's the other measurements? What are the other measurements?
Oh, sorry. The new ones? The new ones are all hydrogen spectroscopy. So one is hydrogen 1s3s, the same as this one, but it doesn't agree with this answer. It comes out over here. One of them is deuterium 1s3s. That measures the size of the deuteron, not of the proton, but the difference between the size of the deuteron and proton is known extremely accurately, so that's equivalent to knowing the size of the proton. And the last one is the 2s to 6p transition. So they all are showing up over here. And people have been giving preliminary measurement results for some months now on those results. So if you don't believe that it's over now, I think you'll believe by the end of the year that it's over at least. So, and I think you should believe it's over already. Okay, that's all I have to say about the proton size. I'll speak quickly about the fine structure constant. So in over the last year, a little more than a year now, we completed a measurement of the helium N equal 2 triplet P fine structure. And the idea here is that we would like to do a measurement at a part per billion accuracy that will give the fine structure constant potentially down to a half a part per billion. It'll test whether we understand QED for two electron systems at the part per billion level. And it will test for beyond the standard model physics. People have proposed spin-spin, electron-spin, that are not limited anywhere else. I'm not sure they're particularly well motivated either, but we're cutting out our little parameter space out of beyond the standard model physics as well. So this measurement's done in a thermal beam. It's a DC discharge that excites it up to the 2s state. We do some laser cooling to condense our beam, and then we pass it. We excite it up in from the 2s state, which is metastable, to the 2p state, and then we drive these transitions between the 2p states. And then we detect that we've done that transition by further laser transitions that go up to highly excited states and then field ionize those states. So we get almost unit efficiency of focusing our beam into our experiment and almost unit efficiency for detecting that we've made this transition. And what that means is we get really good signal to noise. Again, we're using this FOSOF, frequency offset separated oscillatory field technique. So we're getting the same sort of oscillatory signals, but you can see the signal to noise here is good. And it's exceptionally good because this represents 20 milliseconds of data, each one of these data points. And we've put our two separated fields apart at a level that we're losing e to the minus 4 in signal, and we're still getting that signal to noise. In fact, for some of our data, we moved the two fields apart so that we lost e to the minus 10 of signal, and we could still get a good enough measurement. So this is the raw data. This is that straight line that I showed also for the proton size measurement. If you look more closely now, because we have such good signal to noise, and subtract off a straight line, you can see that it's not quite a straight line. And so this is a factor of 100 scale change. Now if you look at the residuals at yet another factor of 100 scale change, you can see that the residuals agree with the modeled line shape that we get. And so signal to noise is fabulous, and everything agrees exactly with what was expected for FOSOF. We measure this interval with many different parameters, different magnetic fields, different pulse lengths, pulse separations. We do different powers, different M states. we analyze the data differently, taking only the central data or taking all of the data or taking some fraction of it. We change our laser parameters by orders of magnitude, and we do things like turn off our laser cooling. We go to different Rydberg states for detection. And this is just a sample of some of the things we do. We basically had such good signal to noise that we could test a whole set of parameters in a matter of a half an hour. And we just really did turn every knob we could think of in the lab. And in the end, this is the number that we got. That was a measurement of the small interval. Now we're doing a measurement of the big interval. At this accuracy, we'll have better than a part per billion determination. And what we need is, this is where I am talking to theorists. We need someone to do the next order of QED theory. So that's, in order to take full advantage of this and turn this into a determination of the fine structure constant, we need one more order of QED. It's a straight single order of QED that we need, but it involves a lot of diagrams, and it's in a two-electron system, so it is a job for a specialist. And Krzysztof Pohutski, who is the specialist, is now taking this on as a project. And with better theory and with this other interval, we will have gotten to this part per billion test of QED, half part per billion determination of the fine structure constant, and we will have eliminated the possibility of exotic spin-dependent electron-electron interactions, or discover them 100 times more accurately than was possible before. I should say that, you know, why would we want to know the fine structure constant best? Well, the best fine structure constant comes from electron G minus 2, and electron G minus 2 could well have physics beyond the standard model in it. I mean, it has hadron physics already built in that we have to put in, and there are dark matter candidates that would affect G minus 2. So we don't really want G minus 2 to be a measure of the fine structure constant. We want a fine structure constant to go into G minus 2, so G minus 2 can be a determination of physics beyond the standard model. That's the reason that I went into this whole project. In the meantime, interferometry has gotten close also to the accuracy of G minus 2. And so we'll end up, by the time we're done, hopefully with three determinations of the fine structure constant. And that'll tell us that we understand everything in all three systems, and there isn't physics beyond the standard model. Or if the G minus 2 disagrees with the other two, then we might feel like there's a possibility of physics beyond the standard model. OK, now perhaps the thing that people here at the perimeter would be most interested in any case, let's talk about our new experiment, the electron electric dipole moment. So about a year and a half ago now, we started a major new initiative to measure the electric dipole moment. And we do this by putting polar molecules inside of a rare gas matrix. So in a solid argon matrix, we're going to implant these molecules, similar molecules that other people have been using for EDM. So we started a new collaboration. EDM Cube stands for Electric Dipole Measurements Using Molecules in a Matrix. And we're choosing argon to do the measurement in. And the exciting thing is that one can imagine improvements on the EDM limit of 3 to 5 orders of magnitude from the current limit, or even more. So that's what got us excited about it. And I guess what I need to show you is that we really, that's a realistic thing for us to think that we can do. Do I need to tell you why we need to measure the EDM? I guess I will. Test physics beyond the standard model. What does the standard model predict for the electron EDM? It doesn't have a prediction for the electron EDM. I mean, we know what order the electron EDM doesn't contribute in, but the order that it does contribute in, no one's calculated what it is. But you can predict that it's going to be about 10 to the minus 40 or 10 to the minus 41 e centimeters. That's really small. I mean, the current limit is 10 to the minus 29 e centimeters. we're still 11 or 12 orders of magnitude below that that the standard model gives us. And the standard model has a small amount of CP violation, and hence T violation, and that's where the standard, where this 10 to the minus 40 comes from. And of course, most extensions to the standard model predict more CP violation, because we need more T violation to understand the matter-antimatter asymmetry, and therefore predict a larger electric dipole moment. So supersymmetry models, what's left of them after the LHC, and what's left of them after the current measurements of the electron-electric dipole moment. So I think I've already said that we need it for that. And the idea is that either setting a much lower limit on the electron-electric dipole moment or actually finding a value hopefully will guide what extensions we might make to the standard model. That's the whole idea. And I would argue that by now, precision measurements rather than high-energy accelerators may be key to testing extensions of the standard model. I mean, we hope to be able to test energy scales that accelerators won't be able to test for a long time. So, for instance, if we had a new particle of energy lambda that was CP violating, I mean, it's hard to get any exact value for what the electric dipole moment would be, but we could make scaling arguments about depending on what order the coupling is to an electron, but we can get some guess of how big it would be. And if you do reasonable guesses, the limit we already have on the electric dipole moment is already testing physics at the 10 or maybe even 100 TeV level. So if we can make a 10 to the 4 improvement, we might be testing physics that's 100 times higher, and we're not going to get there with accelerators for a while.
With 5 orders of magnitude, you will also get the strongest bound on the strong CP phase, won't you?
Yeah, the strongest bound on?
The strong CP phase, just like on Theta QCD. I think I was just reading the number, like with the current bounds, it's 10 to the minus 8.
Yes.
It's 10 to minus 13, you will get
the strongest. Mina was telling me that over lunch as well. So that's true. So, I mean, we better talk about our first two orders of magnitude before we dream about the sixth and seventh order of magnitude, but it's great to know. I mean, the fun part about doing this experiment is it has a lot of legs. It has a lot of room to expand into higher precision. So. Okay, how do people measure the electron-electric dipole moment? Well, essentially by watching electrons precess in a magnetic field, and then adding an electric field and seeing whether they precess a little bit more slowly when the electric field is in the one direction and a little bit faster when they're in the other direction. So it's a differential precession depending on whether the electric field is parallel or anti-parallel to the magnetic field. In terms of angles, the precession in a magnetic field is just the magnetic moment times the magnetic field times the time divided by h bar, I guess, to put it. And then we just add or subtract the contribution from the electric dipole moment. The electric field that we can get in the lab is still quite small, but inside of a molecule, you can get an electric field that's much larger, 10 to 100 gigavolts per centimeter. And that's how all modern EDM experiments are done, inside of a polar molecule. The accuracy with which you can get the electric dipole moment for measurements to date has always been statistically limited or close to being statistically limited. And so it's just given by this simple formula, h bar over 2 times what electric field you can have the electron C times the square root of the number of electrons, the integrated number of electrons, the electrons times the time number of times you use the electron, times the time that the electrons precess for. So that's the statistical uncertainty. And there's not much you can do here. I mean, the electric field, nobody has any plans of anything that would get you more than 100 gigavolts per centimeter. So you have to get yourself either bigger N's or bigger T's. And that's what we that's what we want to do, especially bigger ends. So let's take a look at what other people have done. The ACME collaboration has the most accurate measurement of the electron electric dipole moment. They use metastable molecules, thorium monoxide. They've set the limit at less than 10 to the minus 29 e-centimeters. And then the second most accurate is the Gila collaboration. They use hafnium fluoride plus ions, so molecular ions in a trap, and they've set a limit that's about an order of magnitude less precise than that, but they're busy trying to get this up by one or two orders of magnitude, and there's a plan that's already implemented to try to get this increased by an order of magnitude as well. ACME used about 10 to the 12 electrons and watched them for a millisecond. They had a beam, so the molecules make it through their apparatus in a millisecond. But second of all, they have a metastable molecule, and the lifetime of the metastable molecule, well, they found out recently it's a little longer than they expect, but it's only a few milliseconds. And here, because it's in an ion trap, they can hold them longer, so they're holding them for a second. But it's hard to load a lot of ions into an ion trap, and so they did this experiment with a total of 10 to the 6. I mean, each round was only a couple of electrons that were watched, and then they did it over and over and over again, basically. Both of them got close to this statistical limit. And the question is, why use a particular molecule? We want a molecule that has an electron in an unpaired S state. That's the electron that's in the unpaired S state is the one that we're going to watch precess. And we need it very relativistic. If it's not relativistic, then the only forces on the electron are electrostatic, and it's just going to move to the point of zero electric field. But if there's relativistic forces, it can be at a position where the electric field is not equal to zero. Okay, so what's our plan? We're going to start with barium monofluoride and embed it in solid argon. Argon is nice because it has really only one isotope, and it has absolutely no isotopes that are, or at least 99% is one isotope, and it has no isotopes with nuclear spin, so it's a completely non-magnetic solid. Argon forms a nice crystal, FCC crystal. People have made single crystals of argon that are tens of centimeters cubes. That's already been done in the 60s and 70s. And chemists have been studying these sorts of, the idea of implanting molecules in frozen argon, frozen neon, for 50 years. It's been a standard analysis technique for chemists. So we're borrowing from stuff that people have been doing for decades. Solid argon's transparent. We can still use lasers and microwaves. We can do spectroscopy, look at fluorescence, just like we would in a beam. We just have a frozen beam. The beam is frozen in our argon. And argon is great because these molecules have to be kept separate. If they ever come together, they form dimers, and that's not what you want. So they're keeping them separated. More importantly, the matrix orients the molecule. So we've had some serious modeling done as to what happens to a barium monofluoride molecule inside of an argon matrix, and it's very tightly bound to stay in one position and to stay in one orientation. So by the symmetry of the face center cubic crystal, it can actually be in six orientations, but it can only be in one of six orientations. And one particular molecule is just sitting there in one particular orientation without any electric field applied, and that makes things a lot better for us. And what we can do is we can hold very large numbers of them in our argon. It's hard to make these specialized molecules. We can run our apparatus that makes these molecules for 8 hours, freezing them all into argon, and then we can use that 8 hours worth of beam over and over again every second for many, many months. So we get the advantage of 8 hours divided by 1 second in numbers immediately. And people have been studying the precession of these in electron spin resonance and seeing 1 millisecond to 1 second precession time. So let's take a look at the numbers that we can get. I told you what the numbers were for the other collaborations. Our plan is to start with about 1 millimeter cubed of argon and have about 1 part per billion of barium monofluoride. I'm saying 1 part per billion. Yeah, that's right. 1 part per billion at 1 cubic millimeter gets us 10 to the 10 barium monofluorides. Yes. Just multiply through those.
Can I ask yes. you, if you were to push the abundance of barium fluoride, how much, at what densities would you start affecting the properties of the argon crystal?
So, basically, what we find is that from these simulations is that by the time you're 10 angstroms away, there's almost no variation of the argon crystal. It goes back to a perfect crystal. So you could have them at something like 7 orders of magnitude higher than this, as far as the argon crystal goes.
Yeah.
The problem is that each one of these barium monofluorides is a little magnet.
Yeah, yeah, of course. It affects the coherence time.
Exactly, yes.
So
it's still, I'm still slightly hopeful that we can manipulate each one of these barium monofluorides to be in the superposition of up and down so that it isn't a magnet, so it doesn't decohere the other ones. But that so far that hasn't worked out, and people who are smarter than me have told me that I'm not being smart about it, that I'm still thinking of these as individual things, and I have to do the quantum mechanics of the whole set at the same time, and it's not going to work out. And so I believe them, but I'll really believe them when I do the calculation myself, or when someone does a calculation. So here's the point, is that we can reuse the molecules, these 10 to the 10. If we do take a month of data, and every second we use these 10 to the 10, depending how efficiently we use them, I mean detection efficiency and so on, we will effectively be doing between 10 to the 15 and 10 to the 18 measurements. The precession time here I put at 10 milliseconds, and that 10 milliseconds is just this notion that not every molecule, not every electron is in the same environment because of neighboring barium monofluorides, the little magnets that are nearby. And so you can calculate what the longest precession time you can get is, and it's tens of milliseconds, so I'm putting that number in there. But, you know, just compared this to the ACME, the best measurement, where we had 10 to the 12, here we're going up by 3 to 6 orders of magnitude. They had 1 millisecond, we're going up by an order of magnitude. It's looking pretty good, and you can do the same thing with the Gila measurement on the ions. And so what's our statistical limit here? It's somewhere between 10 to the minus 31 and 10 to the minus 33 e-centimeters. And so that's for a cubic millimeter of argon with a part per billion of barium monofluoride. And so this would be great. That's already 2 orders of magnitude better than the current limit. So 2 to 4 is what we think we can do with a relatively small sample of this stuff. If we go to a cubic centimeter, we can get 30 times better. If we go to a molecule that has a bigger effective electric field, we're using barium monofluoride not because it's the best molecule to use, we're using it because it's the easiest molecule to use. We only need to use diode lasers, which we can buy for a reasonable sum each. And since we are exploring how many lasers we need, we think we'll need at least 5. 5 times a diode laser is within budget, but 5 times the laser that you need to drive things like YBF or mercury hydride is starting to talk about $4 million or something like that. So, and if we took data for 2 years, which we're not afraid of doing, we usually do experiments that last 8 years long, so we would get another factor of 5. So, you know, we can get another few orders of magnitude below this, possibly, is what we're saying. So certainly, we think that we can get many orders of magnitude below the current limit. We don't know how to do this measurement and get as poor a limit as ACME is getting right now. So maybe we'll learn over time, but so far, that I can't sort of make it, can't sort of imagine how it will work that badly. Here's our measurement scheme. The measurement scheme is really similar to other EDM experiments. The only difference is that our beam is frozen inside this solid. The whole challenge of our experiment is to make the solid and the barium monofluoride frozen in the solid such that each barium monofluoride is seeing exactly the same environment, so it is the same as just free molecules. And so we have technical difficulties, but as other than the technical difficulties, there really aren't any serious impediments we see in this measurement. So how do we do it? These are the four states. These are the hyperfine states of the ground state of barium monofluoride. This is basically the F equals zero state and the F equal one state, same as hydrogen that we had. There's an electron, one electron spin, one nuclear spin, just like a hydrogen atom. These F equal one states are no longer degenerate because it's a fixed axis. The barium monofluoride is fixed along a single axis, and that breaks the degeneracy. M sub F is still a good number, but F is no longer a good quantum number. So what do? With a laser, we optically pump stuff into one of these states. We do some RF transitions to get them into an even superposition of this state and this state. If this state has a slightly different energy than that state, for instance, because there's an electric dipole moment, the time evolution of this state will be different from the time evolution of this state. And even though you started by creating an even superposition, it will evolve in time between being an even and an odd superposition. It'll oscillate between being an even and odd superposition. And the rate at which it oscillates tells you how different these two energy levels are. The main reason they're different is from a magnetic field. But now if you do this twice with an electric field this way and electric field that way, the difference between the two will just give you the EDM signal. The beauty is that we already have some molecules that are pointing this way and some that are pointing this way in our frozen sample. And so we'll simultaneously look at the upward pointing and the downward pointing one. They're interspersed with each other, so they're seeing the same magnetic field. And so that's the main trick. A key to the trick is that after we watch them precess, we move them down to these states here. And then we apply an electric field, which does a different thing to the upward pointing ones and the downward pointing ones. We take advantage of the Stark shift that at this step. But the precession itself is with no magnetic field present. And then we do some cycling transitions to look for some fluorescence to see what the relative population of these two are. And those relative populations now encode the EDM for the experiment. We have to explore systematic effects quite extensively. We'll have great statistics, so that should help us a lot. We have a tiny sample size, cubic millimeter, easy to have good shielding and uniform fields. We have no electric field on while the atoms are actually doing their important precession, and that gets rid of a whole class of systematic effects. We're simultaneously looking at the upward and downward pointing ones, and that gets rid of a whole bunch of problems with magnetic fields. The system is cold. That freezes out a lot of physics. It freezes out the vibrationally excited states, the rotational states. They can't rotate. Freezes out phonons, lots of things. It's easy to control magnetic fields at cold temperatures. You can use superconductors to shield things. The molecules are stationary, so we get rid of all sorts of things like geometric phases, Berry phases, motional fields that make magnetic fields look like electric fields, I'm just listing all the things that are the main systematics in other EDM experiments. And we can use a control molecule. We can embed a second molecule with a different effective field, and we can see whether we get if we do see an EDM, we can now see whether it scales as it should with this electric field. And what's nice about these solids is that you can just evaporate the solid, make a new one. You can use different levels of impurities, different imperfections. You can use different inert gases. You can even use different polar molecules. And you can do it on different substrates. And so you can see how sensitive you are to any problems you might have in your solid. And then we have many, many reversals that we can do. And taking the average of the results that we get when we reverse the direction of the magnetic field, when we flip the whole crystal over, and when we do each of the steps that I talked to you about in different ways, in reversed ways, we can eliminate and see systematic effects that way. And we have large, because the molecules aren't moving, we have large dynamic range on all the parameters that involve times, so we can do things slowly. I should quickly just tell you where we are. We've assembled a team to do this. We're looking for more people in our team. We've done extensive modeling on barium monofluoride, on solids, and on the atomic physics. A year and a half ago, we inherited a lab, and we've refurbished it. We put a vacuum system in place. We have a cryogenic system in place. We have learned how to make transparent solid argon and not crack it as it thermally contracts when we cool it down to cold temperatures. We have the laser systems all in place now. We now can make reliably large numbers of barium monofluoride molecules that are isotopically pure. So we're not going to pollute our system with molecules that we don't want, using an electrospray source and a quadrupole mass spec. I think I've run out of time, so I'll just leave it there. The summary is that we measured the Lamb shift. We were working on the fine structure constant and tests in helium. And we've put most of that aside now, and we're really concentrating our effort now on trying to measure the electron-electric dipole moment. And with that, I will thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much. Any more questions for Eric? We'll start with the students, maybe.
Yes, I was wondering about the proton size. So if we now think the smaller measurement is correct, do we understand what's wrong with the larger measurement?
Yeah, so usually I feign, some disgust that people are asking me about, that I've spent 8 years doing a really precise measurement and everyone wants to know about everyone else's measurement. But I'm having a hard time feigning disgust because that's the first question I get every time. I can tell you two things about that. One is that these are really, really hard measurements. I mean, that's why it took us 8 years. We really have to, when you're splitting something a line that much and having so many systematic effects that are important, we study it, we try to get it all right. So maybe I'm not so surprised that some people got it wrong. The previous value was the average. I guess I'm going to tell you three things. The previous value was the average of 12 different measurements. Only one of those measurements was more than two standard deviations from the small measurement all by itself. The average was very far away, but the individual measurements weren't. So there aren't that many people who have egg on their face from those previous measurements. And the third thing I would say is that none of those measurements, none of them that are on the right-hand side were done blind. And so I think there is human nature involved. I mean, in the end, none of the measurements are statistically limited. It's always an estimate of how much uncertainty you have to put in for systematics. And so I think maybe if you're agreeing with the value that you know that it is, maybe it's human nature to say, maybe the experiment's done. I mean, that's why we hide the number from ourselves, so we don't know when it's done. And maybe there's some human nature to say, maybe rather than making your error bar 1.1 times the previous value, make it 0.9. I mean, I'm not accusing anyone of anything. It's just, I do think it's sort of human nature to do that. And so I think that perhaps one experiment led the other somewhat.
Any
But you know, there are lots of systematics that it would be hard to really go back. A lot of the measurements are from the 90s, and it would be hard to go back and really understand what happened to those measurements.
Any more questions?
How common is blinding? Is that something special that you guys did, or is that standard practice more or less?
Well, I mean, in the high energy community, it's completely standard practice. Unfortunately, in precision atomic and molecular physics, it was not standard practice, and it's something that we introduced in our group, and we've pushed the rest of the community to start to do, and most of the community is now doing it. So the EDM measurements are now blind, and it's a hard thing when you spend, I mean, it's hard for the high energy community as well, but it's hard to have a lab spend 8 years doing a measurement and have absolutely no idea. You know, it's something we already know basically what the answer is, and we don't know whether we agree with the basic answer that already was known. So we introduced it. We introduced it badly. The first time we did it, we put a blind in, and when we unblinded, we were 17 standard deviations away from where we knew the answer had to be. 17 standard deviations of the old measurement, like 100 standard deviations of our new measurement away. And so what do you do when you, like, that's the real fear, is that you do that. So you have a drink. It's clear you go and have a drink at that point. So we did. And then when we had our drink, we realized that had that blind offset never been applied to our value, we actually would have agreed with the previous value. And we realized that maybe the program made a mistake and never added the blind to it. And it didn't. And we agreed. So our blind was zero for that measurement. So. But we did have 1 hour where we were very, very concerned about what.
Any more questions? Okay, sure.
Is there a practical limitation on the size of the crystal? Like, can you make it more than a centimeter? Like, it's not opaque enough for the...
Yeah, no, it's there. It's amazingly clear. And I mean, at some point, there will be reabsorption of radiation that comes off that will complicate the measurement. That's probably not for a long way yet. I mean, I've been tempted many times to ask myself, so what would happen if we had a cubic meter of this thing? And then I think, you know, shouldn't I just get the first order of magnitude before I start talking about, you know, whether we can go from 10 to the minus 36 to 10 to the minus 40? I mean, so, but I don't think it's ruled out. I mean, I think if this keeps working, we will keep increasing the magnitude of it. At some point, it's going to have to become a very, very serious experiment to get enough molecules to make a cubic meter of it. So that might take, you know, a 1,000 parallel apparatus feeding in molecules, but, you know, nothing on the level of an accelerator, even a small accelerator, right? I mean, so if it continues to work, I think we continue to scale up is the answer.
And these other experiments just use a gas, or how do they?
So ACME just uses a beam of molecules. So they are finding some ways that they can improve the density of their beam, but I think that's going to be limited. I mean, nobody thinks that they can get three more orders of magnitude out of it, at least. I think that's a fair statement. And the ions, the other experiment used trapped ions. And now there are a number of experiments that are starting to use laser trap molecules. It's technically hard to trap molecules, but people have just done that now. And so that's something that shows some promise, but still only promise over an order of magnitude or two, because there's a total number of trapped atoms you can get and trapping molecules is much much harder to do than that. So if you work through the numbers, it's hard to get anywhere near these numbers. So.
Is there in Singular Spirit of your many years of money don't improvement in DDM, is there any way that you see that for the future there will be a similar improvement in the measurement of the fine structure constant of several orders of magnitude?
No. I mean, I think that the fine structure constant has been slow and steady to get another order of magnitude. I mean, it's not an order of magnitude per decade, even two decades maybe. And so I think that G minus two will get a little better, and the theory to support it, both of them are on track to getting another order of magnitude, I think, over the next decade, probably. And then atomic interferometry, I don't think we'd really know what the limit's going to be on that, but it would really have to be much better than any atom interferometer we have doing anything to date if we're gonna get, you know, more than one order or two orders of magnitude improvement. So I don't think there's any direct path to how you'd get the fine structure constant much better. And you'd have to get it better in two ways, because I mean, we don't want to just measure that number. It's sort of boring. I mean, in the same way that measuring the proton size is boring. I mean, until someone can do lattice QCD and actually calculate what the size of the proton is, which I'm told will happen sometime in the next three decades or so if Moore's law continues at the same rate it's been going. But so until we get to that point, I think measuring the proton size isn't interesting. It's whether you get a different proton size doing different things that allows for the possibility of physics beyond the standard model. So you'd need two measurements of the fine structure constant to make it interesting. And a difference, of course, to make it really interesting. But even if there's not a difference, you're eliminating possibilities of beyond standard model. So hopefully two that are in systems where they have some sensitivity to interesting beyond the standard model physics. One of which at least has that.
Okay, great. So let's stop here. Thanks again for your talk, Eric.
Thank you.